Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us today. He's back from his classes.
They were fun.
You were learning all about restoration.
I was, and native plants.
Yeah, so yeah, you're an amateur naturalist as well.
Very, very amateur naturalist.
Today, we are doing part two of an interview that we had started about a month ago with Tracy Workington and Gavin Watson. And I've been practicing Tracy's last name. This is my preparation for the radio show. And during that conversation, we were talking about our work that all three of us do in the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University. And we touched on a lot of different themes. We talked about, probably centrally, we talked about ethics. And in that, we had discussed the importance of context, embodied knowledge, the differences between individuals and species and what that might entail for our ethical relationships with the non-human world. And we talked centrally, too, about that sort of broad theme of human-animal relations. And it was a good conversation, and I really wanted to have Tracy and Gavin back on to flesh out a little bit more of their ideas and their current directions with their work. I was actually given two papers written by them, and I was excited to talk about the ideas in each of those, and we didn't really get to the papers per se, so I want to hear more about their ideas. So we're going to jump into that, but before we do, we're going to hear a little bit from Carl and the news. I'll just get Gavin and Tracy to say a quick hello.
Good morning, everybody.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so the first news piece is actually something that I wouldn't normally read, a very, very blatantly pro-industry piece from the CBC News entitled, "Will That Be a Low-Fat or a Regular Cow?" And I'm reading it because I thought it gives some good insight into industry discourse. So, scientists in New Zealand say that they have stumbled upon a cow that naturally produces low-fat milk and passes the trait on to her daughters. The biotech company Via Lactea, which I should add is a beautiful name for a biotech company, discovered Marge in a study of 4 million New Zealand cows. Not only is Marge's milk of the healthier low-fat variety, butter made from it is spreadable straight from the fridge, and reports indicate it tastes just fine, too. While Marge was discovered in 2001, scientists needed to confirm that her genetic mutation would carry over to her offspring. Quote, "You have to generate daughters, and then they have to carry a calf and deliver milk," Russell Snell, Via Lactea's chief scientist, told the Australian Sunday Times. "The eureka moment was when we found her daughters produce milk for their mother." Now, this is where you have some very heavy industry discourse. "As well as producing a healthier product, breeding for low-fat milk could also help the dairy industry reduce waste as consumer demand is strongest for skim and lower-fat products." Via Lactea's research is to be summarized in the magazine Chemistry and Industry, which I don't think is a farmer's magazine, this week, with journal articles expected to follow. Also from the CBC News, "Farmed fish given melamine-tainted feed," U.S. officials say. U.S. investigators are visiting fish farms after learning of at least one plant that used feed tainted with melamine, a chemical used to make plastics and fertilizer, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration said Tuesday. U.S. officials did not say whether any of the farm fish given the contaminated feed entered the food supply, but noted that the fish of at least one firm were too young to be sent to market. The FDA said the Canadian-made feed included what was believed to be wheat gluten imported from China, said Dr. David Axon, the FDA's Assistant Commissioner for Food Protection. Axon said while U.S. companies had used the contaminated ingredient in pet food, a Canadian company used it to produce fish meal. He also noted the U.S. agency has notified Canadian officials about the contamination. The FDA says they will test fish samples for melamine to determine the next course of action. What we discovered is these are not wheat gluten and rice protein concentrate, but in fact are wheat flour contaminated by melamine, Axon said. From Kyoto News, 40 slow lorises, a record high, smuggled and seized at Narita Airport. About 40 slow lorises, a protected species under an international treaty, were smuggled to Japan by a Japanese man and seized by customs officials at Narita International Airport earlier this month, customs office sources said Friday. It is the largest number of the primate brought into Japan at one time. according to the Finance Ministry's Customs and Tariff Bureau. All of the animals were alive when seized, but about a dozen died later, the sources said. Trade in slow lorises is controlled under the 1972 Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, known as CITES, or the Washington Treaty. The animals were found in small boxes when the 38-year-old man arrived on a plane from Bangkok on May 2nd, the sources said. The man told a customs official he was asked to bring them in by someone else. Slow lorises, which live in rainforests in southeast Japan, sell for around 100,000 to 400,000 yen each in Japan. And finally, from CBC News once again, a dolphin at the Vancouver Aquarium miscarries again. A dolphin miscarriage at the Vancouver Aquarium has renewed complaints from activists who oppose keeping marine mammals in captivity. Hannah, a 12-year-old Pacific white-sided dolphin, miscarried Tuesday for the second time in less than a year. Hannah has been at the Vancouver Aquarium since 2005. Veterinarians believe the dolphin fetus had been dead for several days when they first noticed something was wrong with Hannah. Annalise Sorg, with the group No Whales in Captivity, said there has been only one successful pregnancy at the aquarium in 9 tries. Quote, 3 orca whales, 3 beluga whales, and 2 dolphin babies have died there, and only one has survived, she said. That's a terrible, terrible record, and the aquarium should not be trying to breed these animals. The aquarium's veterinarians don't know why Hannah miscarried. If it wasn't due to a bacterial disease, they said, she may simply be unable to carry offspring to term. Veterinarian Marty Howlena added that everyone at the aquarium is upset over the miscarriage. Excitement over the pending birth had been building ever since the aquarium announced in January that Hannah was pregnant. The calf's birth was expected to take place sometime this summer. And that's the news.
Thanks, Carl.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we are continuing on with a conversation that we had a while ago, about a month ago, with Tracy Workington and Gavin Watson. And I wanted to continue with that because I felt like we had left some loose ends, and I'm sure we will continue to do that because these issues are quite big that we were trying to tackle. And I just want to welcome you back, both of you back, to the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much.
So at the beginning of the show last time, we heard a little bit about what brought you to your research at York University in the PhD program. And Gavin, you had talked about growing up in a family of naturalists and birders. And you talked about your lack of math skills and maybe what's why you ended up doing social sciences work and some of your questions around wild animals and non-human animal relationships. And Tracy, you talked about the interdisciplinarity of your work and coming out of a science background and then going on to doing social sciences and really liking that sort of debate aspect and sort of taking the strengths of each of the sciences and the social sciences and that importance for you of grounding your research in a real life context, which you talked about your research with whales and orcas. But that was sort of an academic way of sort of giving some broad themes. But I wanted to hear about specific people that have inspired you within the academic field and maybe give our listeners a sense of who they might read to get insight into your own work and who inspires you. So we can start there.
Okay, I'll start. Just in the time you were speaking, a few names really jumped to mind, and especially during my first foray into philosophy, really, when I discovered the whole field of environmental philosophy, there were a number of people that really stood out in terms of really inspiring me, wanting to continue on in the field academically, and just in the way that they questioned or posed questions in environmental studies. And one in particular was Neil Everenden, and Professor Emeritus at Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University, and his books, The Social Construction of Nature and The Natural Alien, were really inspiring to me. And actually another book, another scholar is David Abrams, The Spell of the Sensuous. And actually both authors, both Everenden and Abram, introduced me very gently to the field known as phenomenology, which is a very sort of a terrifying jargony word, but it really just means sort of to get, what it means to get at things sort of before you start adding constructions, before you start layering on all kinds of different ways of thinking and analyzing sort of and encountering things, firsthand and more directly and really paying more attention to, direct sensory experience. Or at least that's the way I interpret phenomenology.
Yeah, I'd agree that sensory experience and sensory awareness are really important for the act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so both of them sort of took a more direct approach to experiencing the world and finding ways to interact with the world ethically through approaching it with a more open mind, sort of with a more attitude of awe and from a place of unknowing. And I found sort of very similar methods or attitudes in the work of Jim Cheney and Anthony Weston, both environmental philosophers. I think it's fair to call them environmental philosophers. And I know Gavin and I have really both been inspired by their work. And they put forth an idea that, especially when it comes to knowing animals, I think it's something we'll get into later on, even in our conversation, but that the ethical process or the ethical stance needs to precede knowledge making. So traditionally when we, especially in philosophy in that academic field, animals are sort of measured against a set of criteria that's humanly defined. And sort of, you know, do they meet certain criteria? Are they sentient? Do they have self-awareness? Okay, well, then we're going to grant them, we're going to extend them a form of human rights.
Do they feel pain?
Mm-hmm. Do they feel pain?
Do they have language?
Yeah.
Whereas Cheney and Weston are quite critical of that approach, saying, you know, you're already setting things up for a fall. You're setting things up so that we're already not questioning even this inherent human right, and that these are these human qualities are what give us unquestionable moral rights. And this, you know, we need to turn it on its ear. And how we even study animals, how we get to know what their qualities are, what their lives are like, needs to be approached ethically in the first place. And they have all sorts of wonderful examples, and one that has to do with whales, so I know it the best. They provide examples of a fellow named Jim Nolman, and he's worked with a lot of different animals. He's a very fascinating man, but they have examples of him. He created a sort of, he called it a floating rhythm section, and we actually donned a wetsuit and went, put himself out in the ocean to approach orcas, wild or free living orcas, and just plays music and rhythms and tries to entice them to want to interact with him, but gives them the option of approaching him in the first place, never coming near him, or if they want to come and check him out for a while, but then they can swim off as soon as they want to. So it's that sort of example of, again, what came up in our first interview about meeting the animals mm-hmm. halfway. And if you want to make contact, we need to make more effort to do it on their terms and to allow them the choice of engaging or not.
Yeah, it's all of the authors that you mentioned, I think, are high on my my list of inspirations and intellectual starting points. And what's really interesting too is this idea of multi-centrism, mm-hmm. where organisms have an inherent a worth, if you want to put it that way, and that it's cogent upon us to find it, or if we're unable to find it, allow the opportunity that it exists without us necessarily knowing what it is or how it exists. And so rather than expanding rights out from the human and including things that are like us based on whatever criteria we establish, a multicentric approach assumes that their organisms have value and worth inherent in where they come from. So rather than dropping a pebble into a pond and then having the rings kind of go outward from that pebble, and that's where you include those organisms. It's like dropping a number of pebbles into a pond, and there are confluences, and all of those waves come together in different ways. More complicated,
yes,
but more generative and open to possibilities that exist in other organisms.
2 weeks ago, we had an author, John Sanbonmatsu, who was at the Brock conference on, and we talked about how animal ethics tends to, at least in the past, I think even largely still today, is often defined by analytic moral philosophy. And, you know, it's people reworking Kant and trying to look at utilitarianism in a way that can do that kind of extensionist moral expanding that will include animals within its moral sphere. And he comes from the perspective of critical theory, and he's using people from the Frankfurt School to get at these issues in a different way, to start from that place of thinking about social change, and they have different starting points. So it's interesting to hear about phenomenology as also maybe presenting a different set of starting points as well.
And to also honor another field that's actually been a huge inspiration for me is also what feminism contributes to environmental studies generally and to animal ethics in particular. And Val Plumwood's work has also been really central to the nurturing of my ideas. And some of her latest work is, again, not phenomenological per se, but she pays very close attention to immediate and direct experiences. And she develops what she calls a dialogical interspecies ethics, but it really means just paying attention to the other beings in our lives that we are in relationship with, and searching for ways of communicating, especially sort of a nonverbal communication, but trying to, again, learn in context how to live together or how to live more ethically together. So she's been a huge inspiration, along with Donna Haraway as well.
Yeah, I wanted to actually talk about that, and then I want to come back to Gavin and hear more about some of your inspirations. But it's interesting you mentioned feminism, because John went back to ecofeminism as well and some of the contributors there. And when I had initially posted the blurb for our last interview on Animal Voices with both of you, somebody had written back on one of the forums, feminism. You know, because I talked about your work being in part at the intersection of feminism, phenomenology, etc. And it was, how would feminism offer, what makes Val Plumwood's work feminist in particular, in terms of some of those things that you're talking about? Can you flesh that out a bit more?
I can. I'd like to just take a step back first. And again, I think this is going to get to the conversation again about ethical knowledge making, how we make knowledge about animals and how we make knowledge in general. So one of the greatest, I think, gifts from feminism too has to do more with methodology than even just substantively. And so it's really infused in the entire process of how I conduct my research and how I report my research, which is from feminist standpoint theory, I guess, where I acknowledge and recognize my embodied presence as the researcher in the work, and strive to make that presence sort of known, to be reflexive about it in all aspects of the research. So I know that I'm coming to this research with certain experiences, certain biases, prejudices, expectations, in any piece of research that I do. So sort of more generally a methodological piece.
Well, and it's not surprising why we spent a significant amount of our first chat talking about where we came from and what it is that inspired us, because that really does inform a lot of our own work.
Exactly. It's situating ourselves first and foremost as, you know, that situated embodiment that comes from even Don Haraway's work in embodied situated knowledges, and really accounting for your presence in the work and accounting for what gets left out of your work and all the experiences, voices, other narratives that can be ignored, marginalized, just unknown in the work that I do or the work that we do. So I think that's a real gift from feminism. When it comes to more eco-feminist theory and feminism in animals, I mean, there's such a long, rich history, and I don't know that I'm the best person to define or describe all of that, but really, it really starts from the place when I read Val Plumwood's Feminism and the Mastery of Nature. It was where I really got a clear understanding of some of the origins and really intimate connections between oppressions of nature, oppressions of women, and oppressions of other marginalized peoples that she does so beautifully in her work. And a lot of other feminist scholars also do. I came to her first. And some of the papers that I've written written or some of the research that I've done much earlier on really traces the connecting oppressions or connecting specific stereotypes and representations that connect women with whales. And I've done sort of a feminist analysis of SeaWorld that connect both their commodification and representations through SeaWorlds and those kind of things.
And you just handed in your dissertation.
I did. Well, it's gone to my committee, so I'm waiting for the green light.
Well, that's great news. So there will be an opportunity, I'm sure. And people, you both have published work. I know that you're going to, Gavin, you're going to have a piece published in the Trash Animals Anthology as well. And we'll talk more about that. And then Tracy, people can find some of your work already online, I think.
Yes.
So if people are interested in hearing more about that, because I'm sure you've piqued some interest. Gavin, let's turn to you and hear about, you said that a lot of the people that Tracy mentioned are resonating with you. For example, David Abram, who's a huge influence now for me too. I sort of went back to The Spell of the Sensuous from my master's and really got excited about it. But who else is inspiring you right now in terms of your work?
Well, like I mentioned as I interrupted Tracy, really the authors that she's mentioning are really cogent and central to my own work. One author that I really like who's not... Who is a popular author who includes a surprising amount of environmental thought and environmental philosophy in his own work is David Quammen, who is would be best described as an independent journalist now. He writes what would be probably best described as scientific lit, but for a number of years wrote an article in Outside magazine called Natural Acts or Natural History. I can't really recall, but these have all been collected and published. And his entry point into these different relationships with organisms is really interesting and a really approachable and I find a generative scholarship, I would call it that. It's really interesting what he has to say and the kind of perspectives he brings and critiques that he makes of the different relationships that typically speaks of humans, different kinds of humans, often quirky humans having with animals and the more than human world. And so I find that that in and of itself is, I've enjoyed reading him and I find him as generative as some other of the authors that I've read. So I just include that there because it may be as appealing as sitting down with Everenden, for example.
Who can be a bit inaccessible
times. At times, yeah.
I remember The Natural Alien being one of the more challenging books that we took in the Masters of Environmental Studies. I don't know if you took that book as well.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic
It is, and it really appealed to me too, because it was one of the first works that I came across that really thoroughly yet respectively critiqued the sciences and critiqued biology, and so that was really exciting.
Right? Especially considering your academic background as well. So let's turn then to one of the themes that came out of our last conversation. And I think, Tracy, you had talked about this tension in your own work. And I think probably all of us feel this about how to make knowledge about animals. You talked about not wanting to overinterpret the interaction between, I believe it was an orca and you in the aquarium, and you had this moment where you're pulling the squeegee down and this eye is looking at you and following you, and there's this potential, this moment of connection or at least some kind of reciprocity or something going on there, and your sort of tentativeness about reading that situation and understanding that situation. And so this sort of relates to my larger question to both of you about, I think as people interested in animal ethics and phenomenology, we want to make alternative claims in the world about who animals are, how they know the world, how they experience, but we're often so aware of not wanting to kind of lay a whole bunch of junk on top of them and say, this is who they are, let's fix them into a particular place. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think there is a real ethical need and impulse to challenge. And on then what grounds do we challenge if we can say, well, we can never really fully know? If we start from that place, Tracy, as you talked about, unknowing, if we can never really fully know animals' experiences, then how can we make any claims about who they are? So that's big. So I can turn it over to both of you. Maybe we'll start with Gavin and come back to Tracy.
Immediately what comes to mind is the fact that I think it's probably very irresponsible to make universal claims about organisms.
Even people,
based on your own experiences. I think it may be more appropriate to make claims about an organism that based on a relationship that exists, however that relationship is defined. And I think we probably have all kinds of examples of some long-term, some short-term relationships that we have with the more than human world and animals that allow us to make different kinds of, give us the space at least to make different kinds of reasoned claims about what a particular organism is feeling, doing, or thinking at a particular time. Tracy and I have had this conversation. We use intuition all the time to assume what somebody else, another human, is doing. We do that fairly often and without really critiquing it in our own minds and think, well, this person, you know, even when you're driving and there's a bicyclist that comes up, or vice versa, you're bicycling and there's a driver, there's a moment there where you're negotiating what's going to happen. Is this person going to cut me off? Am I going to stop? And that happens without this grand reflexive moment where you think, well, is it appropriate for me to think about, do I know this person really? So there's in a sense, there's a relationship there, and you're reflecting on past knowledge and past experiences. And I think it's appropriate to use a similar kind of a way of approaching relationships with animals that you've experienced, maybe not this particular individual, but you've experienced other members of that species, and you may have significant amount of time with those organisms, and then you can begin to predict or assume what they need. And probably the easiest example of this is the relationships that we have with companion animals. They're intimate. I can predict what my dog is needing to do. So my dog is thinking, what it needs, all of those things are part of a relational space, a social space. And I think that when we talk, just talking more, perhaps expanding that out to wild, non-domesticated animals and tying in phenomenology, that sensory awareness, openness to engagement allows for the potential, doesn't necessarily guarantee that it's going to exist, but allows for the potential to come to know an individual and then begin to make some kinds of assumptions. And you know, the old adage is, when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me. The assumption, but in this case, I don't think that's necessarily the end point. I think we can make assumptions about what organisms are thinking or doing or perceiving that probably are accurate.
I think we're going to take a short break. Sorry to cut you off there, Tracy.
That was so well put.
We're going to take a short break. We'll come back with Tracy and Gavin. We'll hear more about making knowledge claims and trying to be having some sense of humility in the face of the non-human world. But then how do you actually make alternative claims, or perhaps even more accurate claims about how animals know, experience the world? So we're going to come back. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have any questions or comments for Animal Voices, we'd love to hear from you. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com, and you can give us any feedback about the program that way. And if you're interested in hearing this program again or any of our 190-plus archive shows, they are available on that website, again, which is animalvoices.ca. We'd love to hear any feedback. If you have any questions or comments for us or ideas for upcoming shows, please do drop us a line. So before the breaks, Gavin was giving us a great introduction to how we might think about knowledge making in kind of an alternative way than we sort of typically think about it, and talking about the need, or the potential anyway, in relationships to elicit a different kind of ethical approach. Tracy, what do you have to say
to Gavin's very excellent description? Actually, I couldn't put it better myself. Just to add to it, and this comes out of conversations that the two of us have had too, there's sort of two key words of attentiveness and openness that I wanted to highlight that Gavin had also mentioned. that, again, we find in those authors that have inspired us, that Jim Cheney, Anthony West, and Val Plumley, they really ask us to be, have a much more open embodied presence when we're interacting with animals or when we're developing relationships. And the attentiveness is really attending to, you know, using your senses and paying very close, respectful attention to what the other, you know, the other animal or the other being that you're interacting with is doing. Part of what's most important in my work too is looking at gestures. So getting beyond the language barrier and really situating, communication or, relationship in embodiedness. And so in the embodied gestures, postures, actions that I'm doing, that animals that I'm interacting with are doing. And there's another whole body of literature sort of that this is founded on, I won't get into. But this is, you know, that we suggests that the embodiment itself is a sort of common ground. So whereas we don't want to trample all over difference, you know, I really want to still respect difference of others and not assume or overinterpret what things mean for them, but that through our embodied encounters and through being responsive to each other, at least signals to me that the interaction is meaningful in some way. I may not know what it means, but it's meaningful in some way, and we are able to negotiate within that relational space that Gavin was talking about and respond to each other in certain ways.
I remember way back in the beginning of Animal Voices, we had Greta Gard on the show, and she really focuses on context, which was something you had talked about last time we had you both on. And we were talking about this question about making knowledge claims and how to do that and how to respect difference and otherness, but also not to deny sameness as well. And she said, you know, as we're kind of walking in that sticky, terrain, that we also have to remember that we're animals as well.
Yeah.
And to not lose sight of that too, and to hold on to that piece as well, which I think sort of speaks to that tension of not fully knowing, but also not pretending that we couldn't have any kind of relationship because we're so foreign to animals or to the non-human world. I thought that was interesting.
Absolutely.
It's sort of an important point. Carl came in and asked us to examine some of the language we're using, and we've used the word generative a number of times, and maybe one of you could talk about what that means.
I think we probably used it in terms of a generative space, and I will attempt a definition. When I speak of generative space, I'm talking of, well, it's interesting. Tracy talked about being aware of senses and approaching another organism and approaching it using being aware, sensorily aware. And so if you can imagine that if there's the possibility to be aware of another organism and that organism is aware of you, that space that's created between, it's not necessarily a physical Euclidean, so by like latitude and longitude, it's like three-dimensional space, but there's the possibility of when one comes together there, that creates different, something different than existed there before, or in potentially will exist after that coming together disappears or moves on or changes. So for me, generative space, yeah, is what can be created as two or more organisms come together that are, there's intentionality there and awareness and some understanding, and then I mean, but and yeah, understanding with all in its different permutations and combinations. Tracy looks like she wants to jump in.
It's so hard to describe. I'm only laughing because I'm thinking, I think we're struggling because we're talking in such abstract terms as well. And I think sort of more abstract, I think of a generative space as being one that opens up or can even leave open possibilities, possibilities for choice, possibilities in the interaction. And just an example I always use, because most people come into contact with them in urban spaces, are squirrels. So if you think of, you know, if you're walking – you know, on U of T campus, and you see a squirrel on the lawn sort of next to you, and there's so many different ways you could behave in that moment. Mm. And you could scream and run towards them, or you could sort of crouch down and make, you know, interesting noises, what you think might be interesting for a squirrel. You know, you could pick up a rock and throw it at. You know, there's so many different options of how to behave in that moment if you wanted to interact with the squirrel. And so the more generative one, I think, for us is the one that leaves open the choice for the squirrel, whether or not they're even the slightest bit interested in, you know, looking at me or interacting with me in any way, would be the one where you would just sort of, you know, leave yourself open and yet not project onto them, or not, I can't think of the word, but assume too much by, you know, just running towards them or even walking towards them and sort of demanding that kind of interaction, mm-hmm. sort of leaving it open for something else to happen, for mm-hmm. their, for a choice to be made. I don't know if that helps kind clarify at all.
I mean, I always go back to that word humility, right? Mm-hmm. And in a really positive way that, yeah, wanting to be open, stay open in the face of what, you know, especially with an animal like a squirrel, right? That the animals that we think, oh, we know what they're about, or they're not even really worth considering. And to think that there might be potential for you to learn something or to stay open somehow, you know, that sense of awe. One of the things, too, mm-hmm. I come back to in my own work, and it's never actually officially made its way into any of my papers yet in my PhD, but is the Buddhist idea of mindfulness and presence. I think that there's definitely some intersections there between phenomenology and that sense of humility and Buddhist practice, at least in some incarnations of being mindful.
Absolutely. Well, and so much of phenomenology, at least the parts of it that I know, are based on the idea of a reciprocity of perception. So that, you know, as a human being, I'm not the only one that has a sensory perception. I'm not the only one looking, you know, in the reciprocity of perception. You know, I'm equally aware of how I'm an interesting object to the squirrel. You know, that the squirrel can smell, can see me, is listening to what's going on in the space that we're both in. You know, there's a reciprocity there that, you know, that we sense each other. And that's what also allows for interaction to occur, because we are aware of each other.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, and I had asked you about this during the break, Gavin, was I'm wondering what this approach, the sort of starting from that place of relationship, thinking about reciprocities, wanting to stay open, what that means for domesticated animals. And so much of the time that we spend on animal voices throughout the years has really been about talking about animals that are excluded from at least public view and our daily interactions in terms of the living being. So we'll talk about factory farms or puppy mills or vivisection labs, where the animals are having experiences, suffering incredibly, and we interact with perhaps their bodies or the ingredients, that the products that come out of that suffering, but not with the embodied living animal unto itself. So what does it mean then for having this relationship kind of approach to ethics, where I'm not necessarily, when I'm eating an egg, interacting with, in that maybe that immediate sense of the layer hen in a battery cage where they can't turn around and their wings can't unfold. What would be the implications, I guess, for both of what you're saying, for thinking through some of those sort of more typically animal rights issues?
Well, I think that right off the bat, having access or a lack of access really speaks to the kind of relationship that we have with domesticated food animals, if you want to call them that. And it's not surprising that if given embodied knowledge opens the possibility of different relationships, and that embodiment comes from an interaction with the living organism, that when you never meet the chicken that's breast that you're going to cook, or consider the cow that the milk that you drank come from, because you've never had an opportunity to engage with it, then it's not surprising that that organism becomes an other, mm-hmm. And disappears.
Well, and I think and becomes an other in such ways. At least I'm speaking specific to Western industrial culture. And actually, I found an entry into the paper that I offered originally. You know, when we're so removed from those chickens in the battery cages and the factory farm, you know, they've been othered in a very specific and deliberate way as sort of a mechanical other. It's where their bodies, their embodied presence, their embodied livingness has actually been redefined.
It's been collapsed.
Yeah, yeah. Collapsed into sort of a machine-like way of being. It's no longer really even animal in a sense because of the deprivation of the conditions there. And I think, you know, part of what I found interesting in the paper where I looked at the use of genetic engineering in industrial animal agriculture is the ease with which a factory farming system lends itself to technologies like genetic modification, because the animals there are already envisioned and defined as sort of mechanical objects that are, you know, meant to be tinkered with.
They're production units.
Exactly. Right. And so they've already been tinkered with to be more efficient, you know, and to raise productivity. There are production units, you know, through breeding techniques, through different kinds of,
how they're, kept in, you know, like the arrangement of the boiler.
The space
yeah,
itself.
Space, yeah.
So that just became almost, you know, a natural progression into using genetic technologies. Well, you know, we can make them have bigger breasts, or we can make cows produce, you know, higher and higher quantities of milk, or we can make them grow faster with the bovine growth hormone. You know, using these technologies to increase efficiency, increase productivity was so easy to do because they're othered in such specific mechanical ways.
So where do we go from there?
Well, I mean, that's part of what interests me, again, in a lot of the people that I've, a lot of the scholars that I've said have influenced me have paid very close attention to language as well, to the ethics of language, ethical dimensions of language. And so, metaphor is, you know, again, one very common way of expressing ourselves, at least, again, within English-speaking Western society. And there's two people, Mark Johnson and George Lakoff, that I'd like to give credit to, and they've wrote a book in the 80s called Metaphors We Live By, and they draw attention to how powerful language is in shaping our relationships and in shaping immediate interactions even. And one of their most common examples is the idea that an argument is war. And so you talk about someone shooting down your ideas or you need to defend your argument. You know, and it places, you know, people in conversation in a very particular kind of relationship. And there are language and cultural, you know, whole culture is just rife with metaphors such as these. And the one that I've really been interrogating is the animal is machine metaphor in a lot of my work, because I think it's sort of almost the cause of so many offenses, at least what I see as really oppressive cultural practices that we have, is that assumption.
Gavin, I think this maybe opens some potentials. Talk about the paper that you let me read, which is really interesting, about the ring-billed gull. And there seems to be, we're getting at, what do you do when there's stuff that we don't want to look at culturally, or the stuff we don't want to engage with socially, and that we're set in particular boxes or paradigms about who animals are. And you wrote about the ring-billed gull that most people think of as a seagull. And it was in the context of writing a paper for the Trash Animal Anthology. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that and tie it into some of
what... Yeah, certainly. So the paper's writing about seagulls as trash animals, and how they are known quite literally, Western culture, as trash birds. They'll go into garbages and dumpsters and find the refuse that we've created, that we leave there for them to eat. And in that act... they're seen quite literally as being garbage. So there's a distancing that takes place, obviously, because we seem to have a real problem with our own waste, the waste that we create ourselves, and then that's implicated in the way that we live. So because the gull, the ring-billed gull, this organism, is garbage, identity gets homogenized, and there's not really an opportunity to there's not even an interest in engaging in this organism and finding out more about it and finding out a little bit more about perhaps why it's interested in eating refuse or why it's in the city of Toronto. And in a sense, then the identity is homogenized and it turns into seagull, and everybody hates seagulls and they get called all kinds of crass names. So it's interesting in the language sense. Through the use of language, that identity is homogenized, and what is a ring-billed gull becomes a seagull. And the language trick that I play in the paper is the fact that we're nowhere near an ocean. So at one point it should be at least called a lake gull. But even then, that homogenizes the fact that there's more than one species of gull that you find in Toronto. And so I offer the suggestion that in paying attention to these everyday common organisms, that you're locating yourself in a place that understands how they're implicated in the way that we live in a city, in the way that we're found. Gulls play a really interesting role in the sense that in the late part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, bird populations were decimated for the use of wings and hats and that kind of thing, so fashion. And bird protection, Society for the... There's a European, particularly United Kingdom, historically... protection towards animals. Originally, some of the original institutions were surrounded birds and the loss of birds. And so ring-billed gulls are a bird that disappeared from Eastern North America, or numbers were reduced to the point where in the 70s, these birds reappeared on the Leslie Street Spit, otherwise known as Tommy Thompson Park, which is a man-made isthmus that was created in the 50s. They reappeared and established a colony there. And that was big news and a symbol of conservation success, in a sense, to come back to the city, a city that perhaps is often read as being devoid of nature, or nature that is problematic and garbage-like. Think of raccoons, skunks, all of these are organisms that we tend to have.
Starlings.
Yeah, pigeons that we tend to have really contentious relationships with, or that are different. And so the gull, when it first appeared in the 70s, was a symbol of, in a sense, success. It was excitement when it appeared. And now, at the end of breeding season, there are quite literally 100,000 pairs on the Leslie Street Spit. And they're at the point now where they're oiling eggs. And at one point, had a falconer with a falcon killing ring-billed gulls because they are overabundant. And I think that speaks to a whole... arc or group of perspectives that we tend to have towards how we define relationships with animals, that if they're in close proximity to us, if they're abundant, if they nest all in one place, or they breed all in one place, or you can find many of them all in one place. Think about problems with pigeons in parks. You may not have a problem with what single pigeon, but when you have 60 pigeons together, people tend to start to have problems. When these kind of things, it's like a mosaic of biological behaviors that these animals have that we in fact find problematic. But what's fascinating is that how we often act as an animal ourselves. We're in large numbers. We like to congregate together. We are omnivorous. Our behavior is really easy. So if you use these kind of biological terms to describe our own behavior,
terrifically inefficient.
Yeah, but we describe, it's a perfect description of the animals that we come to dislike. And the reason why we come to dislike is because they're very similar to us, and in fact, ecologically or biologically, can kind of ride on our coattails and have this symbiotic relationship with us that we wouldn't necessarily consider to be symbiotic. We kind of lack the ability to see that.
Yeah, I mean, it really ties into my own work on abjection and Kristeva's notion of the abject. And I was using it at the Brock conference anyway to really get into that, into those topics that you're talking about, that it is often which we most violently expunge or try to expunge from ourselves, which represents something in ourselves that we don't like. And this doesn't necessarily happen on a conscious level, although I think that it can, but that idea of othering in order to define our own identity. And I think for so much about animals, and specifically the vilification of animals, what we really have at stake is what defines humanity. You know, civility, cleanliness, this is in terms of a North American, a dominant North American paradigm, that all these things that define who we are culturally and socially, you know, they need some kind of boundary, that which we are not. And so often animals become sort of representations of dirt, filth, barbarism, savagery, all these sort of things that we're trying to say that we're not. And I think that Kristeva has something interesting to offer. I think that we're all kind of going in that direction, using different language to get to that place about when we talk about animals, we're also talking necessarily about ourselves and humanity and how we define what that means. We're very much out of time. We have 2 minutes left. I don't know if you want to point people into a particular direction, a website that you like, or your email address, or something for our last 2 minutes, whatever you want to share.
Well, I'm going to throw just a question out to your listeners. I don't know if they have much chance to phone in, but I know they can email and sort of just highlight one of the key findings of my paper was seeing that extension of genetic modification being applied to animals. And there's a very provocative question that arises about whether or not it's even ethically imperative to genetically modify industrial food animals involved in factory farming to suffer less. And Bernard Rolland, you can look up any of his works, he's written extensively on it, really poses this question as a very strong animal welfare advocate. You know, he thinks it's imperative that we actually use this tool, this technology, to make life a little bit easier. You know, if the conditions aren't going to change, then we must change the animal. And it's gotten to the point where now meat is being cultured. It's called in vitro meat. And there's a website called New Harvest that I encourage everyone to go look at because I find it absolutely terrifying.
Okay.
So I'll leave it at that.
We'll have Bernard back on the show because he was on a while ago.
It's
maybe we can get
provocative.
You in here. Gavin, we have no time left. So if you have a website or...
All I'll say is that if you're interested in reading more about the kind of work that I'm doing, you can Google my name, and my first name is spelled in a peculiar way. It's G-A-V-A-N. So if you Google Gavin Watson, you'll come across my website that has links to my work and that kind of stuff. And
great.
I'd be happy to talk about more about it.
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you again.
Gavin Watson and Tracy Workington. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Thanks, Carl. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner.